Good morning, and welcome again to Raise the Standard. I'm Michael Rapp, in studio with my wife, Jean. We're from Brandywine Flags in the Marchwood Shopping Center in Exton. And with us today is Lieutenant Colonel Hank Dietering, retired U.S. Marines. Hank was with us several weeks ago and gave us a really good talk on patriotism, and said that really the only way you can study patriotism is to talk about the patriots. And he gave us a fine example in the form of George Washington and the Battle of the Brandywine and what we learned from that battle and what Washington learned from that. And, Hank, you said that there were a number of examples that were close to home that you could bring up as far as fine patriots. What do we have that you've chosen for today to talk about?
Well, thanks, Michael. I think the last time I was here, I was talking about how our history books devote so little time to war, less to battles, and make almost no mention of individual soldiers. I think I also went on to say that it's the personal stories that really matter. That's what people remember. And today I thought I'd talk a little bit about something that might help our listeners, especially young people in the audience, understand what Americans have endured to protect our freedoms and the freedoms of other people around the world as well. So the story is about Korea and about a local hero. But first, let me start with some background. November 1950, General Douglas MacArthur's commanding the United Nations forces in Korea, but he's doing it from a hotel in Tokyo. And after a successful, though ill-conceived, landing in the south at Incheon, he proudly told the newspaper reporters, "Our boys will be home for Christmas." Boy, was he wrong. MacArthur refused to believe the intelligence reports that were telling him the Chinese soldiers were massing along the Chinese-Korean border and preparing to support the North Koreans. Now, Korea is a country that's actually a peninsula with the Sea of Japan on the east and the China Sea on the west. And MacArthur ordered an assault for Marines and Army, the Army 10 Corps, to move northward. The Army 10 Corps was on the west side of that peninsula, and the Marine 1st Division, commanded by General O.P. Smith, was supposed to attack from the port of Hungnam on the east coast. The Marines were to move up along a single road, Route 10, which wound through the mountains. General Smith was concerned about the mission he'd been given. He was concerned with the plan. He believed the reports about the Chinese that were massing on the border, so he dragged his feet, disobeyed orders, and made preparations for the worst that he could imagine. General Smith had a force of about 8,000 Marines, and they marched north to a point called the Chosin Reservoir. And all along the way, things didn't look good. There was only one way into the Chosin Reservoir, and that was also the only way back out, back down Route 10. And the enemy had already blown up one of the bridges that the Marines had crossed over to get to where they were. General Smith knew that he had to preserve a way out, and Captain William Barber, commanding officer of Fox Company, 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines, who had been a platoon commander at Iwo Jima during the Second World War, was given the job to preserve that way out. Captain Barber and 246 men got the job to hold what was known as Tok Tong Pass. The pass was to the east and to the south of the reservoir, and it was the key to protecting Route 10 and a possible retreat. Captain Barber was taken to the area. He saw the hill above the pass. He sat down and he started to sketch a defensive plan. He stayed there by himself, and he told his driver to go back, find his executive officer, and have the executive officer march the men to his position. The men arrived at dusk. It was still autumn, and it was minus 40 degrees. Men were wearing unlined boots, and they didn't have Arctic clothing. And Captain Barber told them to dig fighting holes in the frozen ground. Most of the men complained, but it ended up saving their lives. Around 4 a.m., Fox Company was attacked by thousands of Chinese, and the fighting was fierce. Listening posts were overrun. Private Hector Caffaretta, who later received the Medal of Honor for his heroic defense, never had time to put on his boots, but at least he survived. Others weren't so lucky. The moisture in their breath froze the zippers in their sleeping bags, and some of those poor Marines were bayoneted where they slept or where they lied. It was a long and terrible night. Men batted grenades with entrenching tools. Men who had been blinded loaded weapons for their buddies, and weapons froze. The corpsmen, kept morphine in their mouths to keep it from freezing, and they stuffed plasma bottles in their trousers to keep them from freezing. Fox Company lost radio contact with the main force of Marines, were sniped at during the day, and attacked every night. They were cut off on their own, but they held for 5 days and five nights. Meanwhile, back at Udemy at the Chosin Reservoir, fighting was fierce, and it was one of the bleakest days in Marine Corps history. The 8,000 Marines were surrounded by 60,000 Chinese and North Koreans, and General Smith was going to have to do something Marines hate to do. He was going to have to retreat. So he gave his Marines an order, attack in the opposite direction, and they were going to have to get out through the Tok Tong Pass, but nobody'd heard from Fox Company for 4 days, and the fear was they'd been wiped out. So Lieutenant Colonel Ray Davis, who headed 1st Battalion, 7th Marines, was ordered to try to save Fox Company's position. And his battalion became known as the Ridge Runners because they literally ran from ridge to ridge to get the Fox Company. They did this not expecting to find anybody from Fox Company alive. But they spotted Fox Company's positions, and it stopped them in their tracks. And a lot of the Ridge Runners dropped to their knees. They couldn't believe what they saw. What was left of Fox Company was surrounded by thousands of dead Chinese, almost all of those Chinese facing the Fox Company lines. To get to the men in Fox Company, the Ridge Runners had to walk over the Chinese bodies. There was no way to get to the Marines that they were relieving without doing that. And as they got closer, they realized that the Marines of Fox Company had piled up dead bodies, frozen bodies in front of them, and they were using those to hide behind to defend themselves. And as the Ridge Runners got up to Fox Company lines, they realized that the bodies on the bottom were the bodies of frozen fellow Marines. There were only 80 of the 246 men of Fox Company still standing, and most of those men were wounded. But thanks to Fox Company, the entire Marine Division was able to get out of the Chosin Reservoir. They still had to rebuild a bridge. They had to fight their way back to the coast. There were 8,000 Marines, 3,600 dead and wounded, another 3,600 casualties from the cold, mostly frostbite. The Army units to the west suffered similar, and the fight back was long and tough, but it was Fox Company that made the difference and saved those guys and made it possible for them to get out of there.
Hank, you had mentioned that there's a local connection to that, and just wondering, we're going to take a break in a few minutes, in a few seconds here. And I was wondering if perhaps on the other side of the break you could give us some examples of local involvement with that particular Chosin Reservoir defense.
I will. I'd be glad to do that. And that's why I chose the story, because I was fortunate enough after I retired to get to know one of those Ridge Runners, a quiet man who returned home and never told the story until one day. And when it did, it had a huge impact on the entire population of a high school.
Very good. We'll be back on the other side of the break and continue the conversation. Welcome back to Raise the Standard. I'm Michael Rapp, along with Gene Rapp from Brandywine Flags. And Hank Dietering is our guest. Hank, we were talking in the first part of the program about the Chosin Reservoir, and you indicated that you actually know one of the men that served with the Marines at that particular time. Tell us about him.
Yeah, his name was Bob Hanf. And I got to know Bob after I retired from the Marine Corps. I was teaching at Unionville High School, and Bob was one of the custodians. Actually, there were three custodians at the high school. All of them had been in the Marine Corps, so we were great friends. And we'd sit around at the end of the day and talk and tell stories, and Bob was talking about being in Korea, and that's when I discovered he was one of the Ridge Runners. And I have to tell you that Ridge Runners are like legends to Marines today. Anybody who was in Fox Company is a hero to anybody in the Marine Corps, and the Ridge Runners are legendary in the Marine Corps. So I was particularly privileged to get to know one. And one day the students came to me and they wanted to interview me for a history class project. And I thought to myself, you know, this isn't a good idea because I've already done a presentation to the history class about Vietnam. I've had an opportunity to talk to students, and they need to talk to somebody else. So I said to them, why don't you talk to Mr. Hanf? And the response was, who? I said, Mr. Hanf, he's one of the custodians. I said, oh, you mean Bob? Why should we talk to him? Well, I said, well, his name's Mr. Hanf, and you know what you should do is go up to the library, read about the Marines at the Chosin Reservoir during the Korean War, the battle at the Chosin Reservoir. Read about what happened there, and then go talk to Mr. Hanf, because he was there, and he can tell you what it was really like. So the students nodded. I didn't know if they'd do it or not, but a couple of days later, they came back to me, and they said, Mr. Dietering, you won't believe what Mr. Hanf told us. Now he's Mr. Hanf all of a sudden, and I felt good about that because I knew, okay, something changed. Well, Bob made a huge impression on those students, so much so that they wrote a series of articles about him in the school newspaper. And when I read the articles, I noticed that Bob had told the students about the hardship of the frozen autumn, told them about the minus 40 degree temperatures, told them about the men who'd suffered from frostbite. One of the things Bob told the students was every time he looked at his hands and saw 10 fingers, or every time he put on his socks and saw that he had 10 toes, he knew that he still had all those digits because he'd followed the instructions that he was given. Every time he stopped marching, he stopped, took off his boots, dried his feet, changed his socks, put his dry socks that he'd carried in the armpits of his jacket, he put the dry socks on his feet, put his wet socks in the armpit of his jacket to dry out so that his feet wouldn't freeze, you know, the wet socks wouldn't freeze, and it kept him from getting frostbite. And he told them a number of stories. He told the students how one night a group of Marines were standing around a fire that was burning in an oil drum. And they're standing around the fire in their sleeping bags. It's like minus 40 degrees, minus 30 degrees. They're all trying to get warm. They're standing around this fire, and they look, and on the opposite side of the fire is a Chinese soldier. He's standing there trying to get warm. And they all looked at this guy. Nobody wanted to get out of their sleeping bag, go get a rifle, and shoot him. And they figured he just wants to warm up like we do. Maybe when he warms up, he'll just leave, which was exactly what happened. And they just, everybody kept an eye on the guy, and he figured his luck was going to run out eventually. He warmed up and he left. Bob also talked about what it was like to leave the Chosin Reservoir, go back down Route 10, and how they were getting sniped at by the Chinese communist soldiers on the ridges, and they were told, whatever you do, don't flinch if a round gets near you because the Chinese will know how close they're coming. Bob told these students a number of things, and the students were absolutely fascinated. But when I read the article that they had written in the paper, there was nothing about Bob being a ridge runner, and that really sort of astounded me. So I said to Bob, I said, Bob, how come you never told those students about being a ridge runner? You never told them what it was like to go to find Fox Company. I said, you never told them what you saw when you got there. And I said, why not? I said, you know, that stuff is legendary. You guys are legends in the Marine Corps. You never told the kids the best part of the story. And Bob, this slightly overweight custodian who's missing a few of his teeth, just smiled at me as if it was nothing. He said, Colonel, I couldn't tell those kids about that. He just never did.
So he just felt that it was too much of a shocking situation that was almost surreal, to the point that he just couldn't share that with them. But he did share that with you, though, did he not?
Oh, yeah. He shared it with me because, you know, I was in the Marine Corps. I could relate to it, and he just thought the kids couldn't. Yet what he told them made such an impact that they wrote a series of articles about him in the school paper. And years later, Bob, who lost his wife and was living on Medicare in a nursing home in Parkersburg, Pennsylvania, Bob passed away. And you would have thought that the passing of a not homeless but almost destitute custodian would have gone unnoticed. Instead, students came home and did Bob's funeral. And Bob had one of the biggest funerals, bigger than any of the teachers I went to at Unionville High School.
These were students that had already graduated and they came back to
these
do this?
These were students that graduated and came back. The eulogy was given by one of the students who is now a lieutenant in the Army. Wow. And they came back. They made sure that Bob had a good funeral. And it wasn't until after that funeral that I had the opportunity to talk to that lieutenant and tell him, I said, you know, you guys don't know the half of the Bob Hamm story. You don't know what a legend his group was to everybody in the Marine Corps today. And I told this young lieutenant about him being one of the Ridge Runners, and he just looked at me and he said, we never knew. But Bob's experience had such an impact on those kids, and it's one of the things that's convinced me that that's what we need to be telling young people today, is the story of our servicemen, the story of people who, you know, they didn't even know that Bob was a hero. They didn't know that I would consider Bob a legend. And he's not the only one in our community that could share that story. There are two other people that I know of who were members of Fox Company on that hill. One of them's name is Bill Patrick. Bill's a retired letter carrier, lives in Oxford, Pennsylvania. I don't think that too many people in Oxford ever knew what Bill Patrick did. Bill was a corpsman. He was one of the guys with the morphine in his mouth and the plasma bottles in his pants. He was one of the guys that took the severely wounded Marines and packed them against one another so that their body heat would keep them from freezing and tried to keep them alive. And there's a retired Marine Corps Sergeant Major by the name of Bob Batdorf who lives in Jennersville. Bob was a private with Fox Company. When he first joined the Marine Corps, got sent to Korea, and he was in Fox Company, survivor, and here, right here in our township. And there's other people in our communities with stories that have never been told, and I can guarantee you that young people would love to hear them. We just need to ferret those people out and introduce our young people, our students, these heroes.
I guess one of the big problems is that, as you'd indicated, Bob Hamm did not want to share some of the horrors that he saw with young students, thinking that that would create an image in their minds that would be a negative. So the one thing would be to identify these different men and women that have served, and then to get them to talk. Now, they would talk to you because you had experienced the problems in the sites of battle in Vietnam, so they knew that you would understand. But to try and talk with a young person, I guess the problem is to, A, identify the individual, and then the second thing is to get that individual to actually speak out, because there's so many families that I know that in the passing of a loved one, they only learn about who this person was when they open the trunk in the attic and they find the newspaper articles and they find the medals and they find the uniform all folded. And now for the first time, they know who this person was during the wartime. So how do we, A, find these people, and then B, how do we get them to talk about their stories?
I think the good news is that the older people get, the more likely they are to finally talk a little bit. How do we find them? I guess we have to go to some of our service organizations and ask for their help. And I know that the Marine Corps League can tell you who some of these people are, and the people who are active in the Marine Corps League will probably talk given the opportunity. The same is true of the American Legion, even the Vietnam Veterans of America. There's a number of service organizations, and I think if we introduced more of our students to those people, and they're active in the schools. I mean, the Marine Corps League will go just about anywhere, and whether it's to teach people flag etiquette or talk about the different service holidays, Memorial Day, Veterans Day, and they have people that they'll bring in who can talk to students. The thing is to get the educators to understand that this is something we need to make part of the curriculum, not just something that we do once in a while because it'll make somebody feel good.
You're exactly right that this is part of the fabric of our being, and were it not for men and women that have served, we would not have the country that we have today. As I've said before, we do not have a better country because of our veterans. It's because of our veterans that we have a country. And we'll be back on the other side of the break. We'll continue the conversation. Welcome back to Raise the Standard. I'm Michael Rapp with Gene Rapp from Brandywine Flags in the Marchwood Shopping Center in Exton, along with Hank Dietering, retired Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Marines. And Hank, in our last segment, we were talking about Bob the Janitor, Bob Hamp, who was a ridge runner at the Chosin Reservoir. And you'd indicated that it was difficult for him to tell his story to the young people because he did not want to share that particular moment. And Gene, I just wanted to, during the break, we were talking about the book that you had written, They Conquer Who Endure, and it's all about the stories of customers of ours at the flag store. Bring us up to speed on that.
Sure. When I was at Brandywine Flags, when I first opened for the first couple of years, I had a lot of veterans come in, and we always give all veterans a 20% discount, and I always say thank you for your service, and if they were in Nam, I say thank you for your service and welcome home. And I would ask them, you know, could you tell me where you were or what you did or whatever? And they would start talking to me. And they, some of them would look away and they'd kind of stare past me and tell me their story. And then they'd look back and almost like, oh, they realized I was there. And I thought it was kind of odd. And I was speaking to a gentleman at a dinner one evening who was a psychiatrist and he had been in the military. And I told him about this. He said, oh, that's not your imagination. He said, that's what they call the thousand-yard stare. He said, they're back there. He said, if you can get these guys to talk, he said, you should write a book. So I did. And I acquired several stories, and it was hard. It was like pulling teeth to get some of these people to give me their stories. And some of them would write them down and hand them to me, and some of them would come in, and I would take it down in shorthand and transcribe it for them. But they didn't want to talk about it, or they didn't think anybody cared. They didn't think anybody was interested. And as I got these stories from them, finally, it took me, wow, I think 8 years. And I got all these stories. And when I, after I produced this book, after I published this book, and some of the other veterans saw the stories that were in there, I've now decided to do another book. And it's a little easier. People are more receptive, and they want to give their stories. The other thing was that after they had given me their stories, a lot of the men came up to me and said, you know, I'm glad I did this because it really gave me closure for some things, especially the Nam vets. And but it's hard to get these guys to talk about it because they don't think it's important or they don't think anybody really is interested. And I think a lot of people, well, I mean, people love the book and they love reading the stories. I get 28 stories in there of my veterans. And it was really a labor of love. But
you know, one of the things, though, if you had purchased a book from us, we would then have book signings, and we would send postcards out to all the individuals that had purchased the book and invite them to come to the store, and then we would have the contributors there. And you could then meet the contributor, talk with the individual, and what have you. And it was just a huge experience for everyone, and the fact that we had men that had never told their stories before, and now people were coming up saying thank you for your story and shaking their hand and saying thank you for your service and welcome home from Vietnam, and, you know, would you sign my story? And I remember there were several that were just taken back by this.
Yeah, that Tom Wise, who was in Nam, said to me that he said, I can't believe this. He said, these people want to meet me, get me to sign my autograph on their book and shake my hand and thank me for my service. He said, when I came home, they were spitting at me. And it was kind of a neat thing to see this happen. And I felt really good about that I was able to give these guys that closure and that recognition, which I know particularly the Nam vets really needed.
Yeah, Hank, we were also talking about an experience that you had at Arlington at the funeral of a son who had fallen, who was a close family friend. Tell us about that with the questions that you were getting from the young people.
Yeah, that experience sort of convinced me that young people today really do want to know what goes on in the service. They're interested in the traditions. They're interested in just about any aspect of what is related to the service experience, and they just don't know. Nobody teaches them. A friend of mine's son was killed in an automobile accident in North Carolina. He was 20 years old. He'd been in the Marine Corps for about a year and a half. And he was buried in Arlington Cemetery. So most of the people who went to his funeral were college-age students. And I was invited. I went, and I'm sure that somebody had told the Marines that there was going to be a retired Marine Corps officer there, because as soon as I walked in, the major who was organizing things came up to me, introduced himself to me, thanked me for being there, and invited me to participate in a couple of the activities afterwards, where the family was asked to come over and talk to the platoon who did the burial and so forth. It didn't take the students very long to figure out that either they knew me and knew I was in the Marine Corps at one time, or they could tell from the way that I was being treated that I was somebody who had something to do with military history. And the students started asking me questions. And afterwards at the reception, they asked me about every aspect of what had gone on. They wanted to know about the cemetery. They wanted to know about the ceremony itself. They wanted to know about the everything from the firing squad to the bugler, to where did these Marines come from, what kind of training did they have. They were full of questions. And it dawned on me that the reason they were asking these questions is because nobody teaches them anymore. It's not that they're not interested. It's almost as if the teachers today don't have the background or the experience, and we've crammed so much into our curriculum that we brush over American history in 1 year. Well, how do you study American history in 1 year in high school? And there's so much that gets lost, and one of the things that gets lost is teaching students about military history, about military tradition, and they just never really get to talk to the servicemen. When I was a kid in high school, these were my teachers. My teachers were in the Second World War. My teachers were in the Pacific and in the European theater. Today, there's no draft, there's no connection to the military, and people are removed. And we need to make a concentrated effort to make that connection again. And as Gene's pointed out, it's a good thing for the servicemen to get an opportunity to speak. And I think one of the things that Gene didn't mention was that a lot of guys are a little reluctant to talk about what they experienced because they don't want to be judged by somebody who didn't have a similar experience and couldn't relate to it. And we're really good at judging people and deciding what people should do. You know, we Monday morning quarterback everything. We analyze what a police officer should have done in the 2 seconds that he had, and we talk about it for hours. And the military guys are afraid to talk to somebody who doesn't share their experience and doesn't come from the same background.
The psychiatrist that I had spoken to and was talking about how the people were talking to me about their service records, he said that I was not a threat to them. They didn't have to sit across from me at, you know, Thanksgiving dinner at the table or anything like that, or they never had to see me again if they didn't want to. So they could talk to me and, you know, not worry about me putting it in the newspaper or something, other than putting it in my book, of course. But I think they felt safe talking to me because they were not emotionally involved with me.
I think that's true. And once they start to talk, they tend to open up a little bit. Some of the old vets are never going to talk to you. I remember my uncle, who was in the Pacific. He was in the South Pacific with the Navy in the Second World War. And we used to kid him about being in McHale's Navy because that's all I could relate to, and my uncle never talked about it. But one night, and he lived in the second house on our farm, and he was almost 90 years old, and I know he'd had probably had a drink before dinner. My uncle said to me, we were watching a show about Tarawa, the Marine landing on Tarawa. My uncle said to me, I drove one of the boats and took 40 Marines to that beach in the first assault wave. Nobody made it to shore. In the Tarawa, they landed 100 yards out in water and had to walk through. And he said to me, then I had to go back and get more. It was the only thing my uncle ever told me about the Second World War, other than being in the South Pacific on a boat and joking about McHale's Navy. It was just kind of tough for him to relate it, and that's all that anybody ever knew about my uncle.
And you know, that's the case also is he was a kid probably at the time, and to have that kind of experience at that age has got to be the most difficult thing that you have going. We'll be back on the other side of the break, and we'll continue the conversation. Welcome back to Raise the Standard. I'm Michael Rapp, along with Gene Rapp from Brandywine Flags, and our guest is Lieutenant Colonel Hank Dietering, retired U.S. Marines. In the last segment, we were talking about men and women telling their stories to young people so that we know what has actually transpired. And one of the things we talked about during the break was the fact that the news media has basically been indoctrinating us, if you will, into the fact that America is effectively a force for evil, or it's we've not done the right thing, and we've tried to police the world and whatever, and that the world hates us. Hank, you had some experiences personally with the exact opposite, and for whatever reason, the news media refuses to accept this and to publish it. So give us a couple of examples of that.
Well, Michael, I told the story in the beginning of the program about Korea. And I think Korea is a really good example of a place where the United States preserved the democratic ideals for a nation. I was in Korea in the 70s, and to tell somebody that you were a Marine when you were in Korea, they immediately almost revered you. They were so appreciative of what the Marines and the servicemen had done because we saved their country for them. And if you look at where Korea is today, look at South Korea and what a booming economy they have. My son was in South Korea 2 years ago, brought me back pictures of Seoul that I almost fell over. I couldn't believe how that place had changed and what their economy's like and how productive those people are. And then you look at what's happening across the border in North Korea, and there's nothing there. And people live in poverty. They have very little. And most of them would like to get to the South if they could. The North Koreans do a great job of propaganda and try to boast of their country, but the truth of it is the place is a mess. We saved that country for them.
You look at the difference between North and South Korea. In North Korea, most of the people don't even have electricity. They don't have food to eat. They're in really bad shape. And like you say, the propaganda is such that, oh, we think that North Korea is this this booming economy, and it's totally opposite. And we're not getting the truth on any of this stuff.
And another example is to go to Europe. I mean, we saved Europe. During the Second World War, we did it again the First World War. I was on a cruise in the Mediterranean where I was a shore patrol officer, and when we were in a port in France, the captain of the carrier I was on asked me if I would attend a meeting of World War II veterans that he'd been invited to go to, and I went in his place.
These are World War II veterans of France.
French veterans. A lot of them worked in the resistance. Some of them were in service in England. Some of them worked with the Americans. These gentlemen came to me, and every one of them thanked us for what the Americans had done. And they told us, you know, as long as their generation was alive in France, the Americans were going to be welcome there because twice, and that's what they said, twice you've given us back our country. They really appreciated what we did, and it's sad to hear things in the news today and have our young people get the impression that we're bad guys, we're sticking our nose in where it doesn't belong, because historically that's not been the case. Historically, we really have done good work, and our servicemen need to be proud of that. Now, how do we change it? I think we have to start by getting the attention of the people who make decisions about what we're going to teach our students, and we have to get teachers interested in inviting some of our servicemen in and taking the time to make this part of our education of young people.
You know what would be another avenue to accomplish that, and that would be churches, maybe some Sunday school classes or the youth groups or something like that could have veterans come in and talk to them, or they could have lessons on what exactly we have done over the years as Americans to help other people in the world. Because it's really hard to get into schools because they're so liberal, and that's a shame. And of course, the media just tells lies all the time, and it's hard to get the truth out to people.
You had also mentioned that when you were in France for the D-Day celebration last year, that actually the French government funded some transportation expenses.
Yeah, I wasn't there, but I know that the French government funded military veterans from the United States who participated in the invasions at Normandy to go back and be part of the ceremonies. And the Koreans do it on a regular basis. They have ceremonies to honor the different activities of the Korean conflict. And I have some friends from Chosin Reservoir who were invited back, and they're called the Chosin Few. And they were invited back. The Koreans paid their way over there, put them up in hotels, had dinners and banquets for them, treated them like royalty, and really appreciated what they did. You know, I think some of our allies get a bum rap. The French, I know, do. People tend to look down on the French. But the truth of it is, I think there's a lot of appreciation for what Americans have done and what our intervention in some of these conflicts have meant. And I think that's something our young people need to know, that we have a long and proud history. And
you said that in France for D-Day that they actually paid and put up the veterans that came to visit from America that had been involved in the Normandy invasion?
Yeah, they're few and far between, and they were happy to have them. And I've talked to a few people that went over there, and I've talked to people my age who went, you know, with their parents, with their fathers, and they just could not believe how well-received they were, how people wanted to invite them into their homes, talk to them, thank them, take them and show them places where there were monuments or memories of the American servicemen that were still in the towns that were so close.
So effectively, the people in France recognized the fact that were it not for the American military veteran, they would not have a country either. They would be ruled by Germany and the Hitler regime, or the Japanese would have ruled the various areas, would have ruled the United States had they had the opportunity to come and conquer us as they did. And it's incredible that we have such a negative view portrayed by the media that is totally untrue and unfounded.
And the reason that one of the reasons they're able to get away with that is because the children are not learning in school the true and real and honest history of America and what a great country we are. And so then when the media comes along with these lies, the kids just, take it for granted that that's the truth.
Yeah, because I've often said that if you say something often enough and with enough passion, it becomes fact. It doesn't matter if it happened or not. It becomes fact. And any lie or any misinformation that is offered out there, people actually believe it because no one's challenging it and no one has a way of knowing what the actual truth is.
Another thing that should be done, too, is for the people, the parents, grandparents, great-grandparents today should make it a point to educate their children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, nieces, nephews about the true history of this country because they're not getting it in school.
Yeah, because you had mentioned earlier, how can you learn American history in 1 year? There's so much that has gone on there. And if you do not learn history and learn from history, it will repeat itself. The average lifespan of a culture that has been dominant in the world is 200 years. You look at Greece and Rome and Spain and England. And we adopted the Constitution in 1787, so 1987, we're on borrowed time. And that's a fear that I have, that my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren will not even know what this country is all about. We look at the history revisionists that are teaching things in school today that are totally untrue. And as you had mentioned, a lot of the teachers don't even know. They've been indoctrinated into this also.
I hate to say this, but I think you're right. I think we're living on borrowed time. And how do you turn it around? I guess it takes somewhat of a grassroots effort, but you need to start by answering the questions that young people have, because I'm convinced that they just want to know. And we need to do a better job of telling them about the history of this country by telling them about people who made that history. And I'm convinced that trying to put a brief explanation of what we did and why in a book and sum it all up in a few paragraphs doesn't work. What's better is to tell them the story of somebody who was there, what they did, and let that speak for itself. You know, the Bob Hamps of this world have a greater impact on students than their history teachers did, because they were there and they were credible and they were believable. And Bob only told part of his story, but the part of his story he told was so impressive to those young students. Maybe Bob was right. Maybe he didn't need to tell them that he was a Ridge Runner. Just to tell them what it was like and what he experienced and the outpouring of respect for Bob. I just, when the kids came back and said to me, "You won't believe what Mr. Hanf told us." And he was just Bob the janitor until they went and talked to him. And suddenly he was Mr. Hanf, he was important, and he was important enough for them to come home to his funeral. That doesn't happen very often.
Well, we thank you so very much for being that catalyst and introducing the students to Mr. Hanf, Bob the janitor. And we thank you for coming in today. We welcome you to visit us at Brandywine Flags in the Marchwood Shopping Center off of Route 100 north of Exton. We have all types of flags and items that are of patriotic nature. We're coming into the spring of the year. We'll be coming up to Memorial Day next month, so we enjoy.
We have a lot of patches and decals and so forth for all the different service groups and divisions and license plates and all kinds of goodies for veterans out there.
We're enjoying the nice weather now and hope that you enjoy it the same. And we welcome you to come over, visit with us, and we look forward to seeing you next week for Raising the Standard.